You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 28th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alicia Pleonisi, author of In Whose Ruins, Power, Possession, and the Landscapes of American Empire. Meanwhile, Russian forces are reportedly taking a different strategy in its offensive in eastern Ukraine, making more measured advances as opposed to the all-out assaults on certain areas that we've seen in previous weeks. In the meantime, the House of Representatives passed a mostly symbolic bill that would have the U.S. sell seized Russian yachts for Ukraine aid. But, like, can we do that for real, except with American billionaires?
Got a lot more where that came from.
Yeah, and can we get universal health care out of it? I mean, that's called taxation. Meanwhile, top congressional Democrats are also exploring bills to address gas prices, one that pauses the gas tax, and one that punishes oil companies for price gouging. Guess which idea I bet they'll go with? This also comes as a bipartisan group of senators have begun to work together on immigration reform, which I doubt will go anywhere because of the filibuster, frankly. Moderna has announced that it is seeking emergency authorization for its COVID vaccine for children 6 months to 5 years old. California is facing record-breaking extreme drought conditions due to climate change. The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California declared the water shortage emergency on Tuesday, asking residents to reduce their water usage. And lastly, Minnesota's Department of Human Rights has concluded its two-year study on the Minneapolis PD, and guess what? It turns out that the police force there is systemically racist and has a, quote, culture that is averse to oversight and accountability.
I'm sure Jacob Frey will get right on that.
Any day now. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It's the NFL draft tonight. Bradley, we were preparing for the show today and I started talking.
We were preparing for the draft today.
Right, that's more accurate. Before Matt got in, I think I tried to focus on work like three separate times and then just ended up talking to Bradley about the draft.
Can we just take a look at the Jets' recent drafts?
Yeah, I went back to the archives and was like, I think I was thinking of Calvin Pryor. But I'm very invested in, you know, the two New York teams own 40% of the top 10 picks in the NFL draft this year. Two first round picks for the Jets. Two first-round picks for the Giants. We'll see how both Bradley and I are feeling tomorrow.
You're obviously incredibly well-educated, and you're more than qualified to distribute this information.
Joe Rogan talking to the Carolina Panthers front office.
This is good. All right, anyway, oh my God. If they actually take a quarterback at six, I'm going to lose my mind.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
Whew. All right, anyway, Lots happening in that area, and plus it's kind of a slow news day, so that's my excuse for why my energy is being focused there. But Marjorie Taylor Greene continues to dominate the news cycle. Let's turn to this. This clip came out yesterday, but she's been in the news because essentially free speech for the people, which is in election reform, campaign reform organization, filed a lawsuit against her in Georgia, basically saying that she should not be eligible to run for re-election because of her comments about January 6th, and that essentially she'd violated her oath of office by being an undemocratic fascist. I mean, yes, but I would argue a majority of Republicans also fall under that umbrella. There's just a focus on her based on her outsized influence in the Republican Party because of the amount of donations she receives. And she's also really the figurehead for the Trump constituency that a lot of people in Washington are uncomfortable with reckoning with.
Yeah, she's really the leader in the battle of ideas for the Republicans.
100%. And so she's kind of instructive, honestly, because it's helpful to see her, because when you can hear, you hear what the Republican base thinks when she speaks. And here's an example of this, where she was on with a Catholic activist speaking about religion and criticizing the church's roles of resettling undocumented immigrants and refugees in this country and helping them, I don't know, live a life that isn't marred by poverty and giving them food and shelter, things that churches are supposed to do. Marjorie Taylor Greene has a different take on that.
What it is that Satan's controlling the church. The church is not doing its job, and it's not adhering to the teachings of Christ, and it's not adhering to what the Word of God says we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to live. And what they're doing by saying, oh, we have to love these people and take care of these migrants and love one another. This is loving one another. Yes, we are supposed to love one another, but their definition of what love one another means destroying our laws. It means completely perverting what our Constitution says. It means taking unreal advantage of the American taxpayer. And it means pushing a globalist policy on the American people and forcing America to become something that we are not supposed to be.
Yes. Jesus famously railing against globalists. That was kind of his thing, right?
I'd love to introduce Marjorie Taylor Greene to this carpenter from Nazareth, who is famously uncharitable.
The right. book of Matthew, for which I'm named, actually.
Oh, really?
Indeed. Has a little phrase, a verse in it. For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I mean, this woke stuff goes really way back to, like, the New Testament, I think.
Honestly, I mean, that's how pervasive critical race theory is you just got to read between the lines and you can find it, particularly in the Old Testament. I mean, shout out to the globalists there. We all know what she's referring to. I mean, she's speaking with a Catholic host, so I think this is useful for him, honestly.
Yep, the Gospel of Matthew was race Marxism.
I mean, so... Again, we're not in the business of, like, bashing religion in and of itself, because as you see, conservatives like her are now just criticizing church leaders in general for being charitable to undocumented immigrants. And it's an indicator that the church is used for religious conservatives, evangelicals, as an extension of whiteness and white supremacy, as opposed to any, like, actual commitment to the principles. It's a part of an identity indicator.
And for something like the Catholic Church, which does not just cater to white people, has a global sort of constituency, shall we say, that's why you see a lot of white Catholics in America say things like this, or mm-hmm. be like, Pope Francis is the Antichrist or something. Like, people literally go there. It's pretty wild. Like, I'm pretty sure I have family members we don't really talk about this stuff anymore, but like, I have sense that there's some emails, like email chains going around with like certain types of things about Pope Francis being like too into non-whites, basically.
Well, because he's been at least economically progressive in some of his rhetoric.
The climate change stuff.
Doesn't, you know, think gay people should be stoned, for example. So that apparently means you're in bed with, but like that, this guy is using her as an opportunity probably to go after evangelical Protestants in the country if he's a Catholic host. So there's like a dip, but that's not really the interesting part of it to me. What is interesting, one, is how she's insane. She's absolutely insane. Two, how this is very much in keeping with the base of the Republican Party. And three, how hypocrisy shaming these folks does nothing. Nothing. I mean, we can call out how Jesus was pro-refugee and pro-socialism and against everything they stand for until we're blue in the face. But it really doesn't matter. They want to use the institutions of churches to push for their bigotry. And those areas are in hotbed of conservative thought. So it's a vehicle to push for your conservative beliefs. It's more fertile ground. And frankly, their complete lack of tether to any moral consistency or logical consistency should be instructive. There's no way to win a battle with them on those terms. You just have to beat them. You just have to beat them electorally, in the public space with ideas, as opposed to wagging your finger at them, because they literally do not care. A church is doing charitable work for undocumented immigrants, refugees, etc. Oh, they're working on behalf of Satan. Like, that is something that we should all internalize.
It should be an opportunity.
Yeah, right.
Like, for the Democrats, like, it is completely insane. And it is, it's like, you need to use their insanity as a wedge issue at a certain point.
Yes. But don't worry. Politico is reporting a week ago, Democrats realized that it might be a good idea to fight back against some of these bills that are coming up in the state houses against critical race theory and gay people, trans people, etc. Anti-abortion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another case of not understanding the stakes when all the people were saying, yeah, you don't want to give the crazies any oxygen. It's like, the crazies are attacking public schools.
Yeah. Right? It's already happening. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Alicia. We are back, and we are joined now by Alicia Pulionisi, author of In Whose Ruins, Power, Possession, and the Landscapes of American Empire. Alicia, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I particularly, you know, requested that our team book you, because your books sounded so fascinating to me, and it was. You focus on four different sites in particular in America as a way to explore colonialism, oppression, power, and particularly white colonial relationships with indigenous people in the United States, this cycle of power and ruin. Can you explain the genesis of this idea and why you chose to focus on these stories as a part of your whole thesis, I guess?
Yeah, so it actually came out of my first book, which is about a topic that on its surface, I think, seems very different. It's about parapsychology and its origins in 19th century psychical research. And so as I was working on that book, which is a lot of it is about sort of how regular people were experimenting with like powers of mind, clairvoyance, telepathy, and things like that. And I encountered this one case where an individual had a psychic experience where they believed that they had seen into the past, into ancient North American past. And they had this experience while they were touring a mound, an indigenous burial mound in Miamisville, Ohio. And that was such a strange scenario that I had to learn more about it. And that sort of spiritual connection with the North American past, both evident in the person's vision and in the fact of like mount tourism as kind of a routine aspect of like travel in the 19th century, that made me look at sites and look at like tourism and the ways that people moved across the land and sort of consumed the landscape in certain ways. And so that was kind of like a weird entry point into this project. But yeah, like one aspect of it was like tourism practices and like the desire for like spiritual connection that often turns into consumption. And then that sort of leads to like an association with resources and resource extraction.
Well, can I, one, I mean, that brings up a lot of different branches of kind of new age spirituality, but two, can I ask if this person who had this, what their race was?
Oh yeah. So this was a white person. And right. So this was like settler tourism of what was then the West, the Ohio River Valley.
Right. And so that very much is in keeping with a lot of your writing here, the exploration of mysticism as a theme from white settlers using mysticism to justify their extraction, or at least make, allow their minds to be okay with what they were doing. And then also just the more organic mysticism of these sites from the natural perspective as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that I, you know, have obviously thought a lot about, like that there certainly are many ways of understanding the world and encountering spaces and history. But like, I think the key thing is like understanding and being curious about the history of these practices themselves. And the functions that they've played, and that this desire for connection, understanding, meaning can kind of serve political purposes.
So can we start with the myth of the mound builders as one of the first stories that you tell in your book?
Yeah. And so the vision that I mentioned at the beginning of this tourist in Miamisville is actually an exception to the norm. That person had a psychic vision that actually disproved the mound builder myth. And so that's why I especially found it fascinating. So they had, you know, they were espousing like what we would now consider to be like a correct historical view that indigenous Native North American people built the mounds. However, there was a very popular argument throughout the 19th century that these earthworks, which included both sort of conical burial mounds, effigy mounds that were shaped like figures or animals, and ceremonial mounds, like the one at Cahokia, that throughout the 19th century, there were purveyors of these alternate histories, that those sites had been constructed by a quote-unquote lost race, potentially of European descent, although not always. And there were so many different sort of proliferating alternative histories that it almost doesn't matter the specific one. It's more about casting into doubt any association with indigenous history and claims to the land.
So do you mind expanding a bit more on that story, how I guess it came to be, how it persisted, and really, you know, how it does fit into larger themes that we still see in American thought today, like manifest destiny and other ways that white Americans perceive their role on this continent?
Yeah, so I mean, you could read it sort of as the antiquarian expression of manifest destiny, I suppose. But and there's a phrase that an archaeologist whose name I am not going to remember or pronounce correctly, but it's not my phrase. But this idea of the colonization of the past, that in tandem with sort of westward expansion and indigenous dispossession, there was work to be done in the sciences by antiquarians, at first antiquarians, and then sort of more professional archaeologists, to tell a story about the history of the continent that supported and justified what was being done in contemporary politics. And so, of course, there were always conflicts over, there were always people who opposed that narrative and who argued for the indigenous origins of these monuments and earthworks. And so it's not that it was a done deal, but the narrative of the Lost Race was very popular. And, you know, I think because it served these sort of emotional purposes.
I just have to jump in. I'm from Mandan, North Dakota, and the Mandan Indians, there's a similar myth that a Welsh prince in like the 17th century went off with a bunch of his sort of like servants and stuff and somehow crossed the Atlantic and went up the Mississippi and then founded the Mandan Indian tribe. And it's just like, it's really, Thomas Jefferson believed that when he bought Louisiana. And it's just, yeah, like the need to believe that, oh, Europeans are there amongst this, like it gives some sort of claim or something. So there is a need for that sort of myth.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to point out that it is associated with claiming, because like on its face, I think, and you know, there's this world of sort of what some archaeologists call like fantastic archaeology or pseudo archaeology that tells of these, you know, incredible journeys in antiquity. Transcontinental or, you know, transoceanic journeys. And, you know, it's like we know that, you know, Vikings did reach North America. And so we can't like deny the possibility of any such things. At the same time, it's like, there's no evidence for that. The Welsh story is definitely, yeah, it's definitely a fantastical claim, but yeah, like what is the political and affective function of it?
It's to, you know, promote white supremacy in colonial ambitions. I mean, that's a broad way of characterizing it, I would say. But I didn't know that example, Matt. I'm sure there are countless others, but you also zero in on Henry Roe Schoolcraft, who married an indigenous woman and then basically perpetuated a lot of tropes through his writing, but was perceived as the foremost authority on Native American culture for a little while, or perhaps that's too broad, but he was able to capitalize on his characterizations of Native American culture as a white man. What did you find in researching his work and his life and his place in America at that time?
Yeah, so I found Schoolcraft very interesting, not in sort of his like having achieved great power, but in his kind of representativeness of this kind of like middling person who's like a functionary of empire, and who sees the value of taking indigenous knowledge and shaping it in particular ways so that it is serviceable to this project of US empire. And so he is sort of self-educated through sort of a series of previous business failures, gets appointed to the position of Indian agent for the Office of Indian Affairs, also known as the Indian Bureau at that time. And so he's sent to the Michigan Territory. And like a lot of settlers who were there previously as part of a fur trade, he marries into an Ojibwe family who are kind of like very prominent political leaders in the region. And so he is accepted into this family and is, you know, clearly like loves his wife and children. And yet he's part of this project and not only sort of governing this territory that has been effectively conquered, but he gets very interested in collecting Ojibwe traditions and stories and publishes those under his name as sort of material, not just for the like governing of indigenous people, but again, for white Americans to feel this kind of affective connection with place and a sense of like that they're inheriting these sort of characteristics of the country.
Right. So that you mentioned this concept of ownership too, and it seems like he plays a role in scholarship or in writing where people, white colonists, white people can feel a connection or ownership over the land and thus, and the mysticism associated with it and thus native culture. But these myths are not just there for rhetorical purposes or as bedtime stories. They're there for ownership that leads to mass commodification of land and also of everything that flows from that. So do you mind just talking a bit about that? Because then we can, I think, transition into how the early oil barons begin to utilize this.
Yeah, and so that's definitely the thread of the book. These four sections are like about each about different resources, which is a very ambitious thing to do. And I'm not an environmental historian, so it's kind of, I think for a trained environmental historian, it might be insane to try to do that. But for me, I was following that thread of affective claims and these feelings of ownership and specific resources. And the land is sort of the primary resource. And, you know, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz writes this in her Indigenous People's History of the United States that, like, land is the first source of wealth and power for the U.S. And so the next section of the book looks at the big mid-19th century resource, which was oil, and was first extracted on an industrial scale in western Pennsylvania. And so that discovery of oil also has sort of this mythology woven around it, which includes both these aspects of kind of like divine benediction, like oil from the rock. The biblical quote was right. Just all over the oil industry promotions of this new oil region, and also includes some some misinterpretations and misuses of indigenous history.
Right. So they basically, I was super unaware of how prevalent it was for the early oil industry to work backwards from certain spiritual claims. You mentioned an example there, but do you mind expanding a little bit on some of the others?
Yeah, so, and a lot of this comes from Darren Dochuk's great book, Anointed with Oil, which kind of like very extensively documents this kind of spiritualization of oil as a resource, which includes, and kind of in the early days of oil, you know, in the 1850s, when there's not any kind of scientific way of predicting its location, it really is a matter of kind of intuition, and there are a lot of people are making different assertions about their powers to commune with the unseen world of oil. And so you have like a lot of different approaches, all of which, claim this kind of like special communion, and are plugged into this kind of overarching teleology, again, of manifest destiny, of like, this is something that has been, this is a resource that has been laid in store for millennia until the right people were there to utilize it in the right way. Again, associating this very sort of classic 19th century progressive narrative, associating white U.S. civilization with the culmination of the purpose of the land.
And with this explosion of this resource that has been the bloodiest resource and commodity that has driven so much of the worst parts of capitalism over the past plus 100 years plus and more 200 years. And so it really is a stark contrast for it to be portrayed as this, discovering it as this natural phenomenon of beauty and mysticism versus the reality that we deal with in 2022 of it completely being this dark force that's polluting our planet and the extraction of it ravaging lands and, by extension, of course, indigenous people that live on those lands. And that was, but all that was true at its outset. It's just that there, it was new and novel. So there's a way to assign it some sort of mysticism, not to overuse that word.
Yeah, well, and that was one of my like research questions. I was like, is this cursed? Like, how cursed is this? And of course, like, that's a historical thing and a relative thing. And so, you know, I'm looking at these people who are literally communing with spirits, what they consider to be heavenly spirits who are guiding them to oil. And part of that spiritualist mythos is also the belief that what they called Indian spirits, which were an important part of spiritualist cosmology, which is to say the indigenous dead in the afterlife, who they gave this particular role of being spirit guides. They believed that these Indian spirits were especially, you know, helpful in leading them to oil, again, fulfilling this destiny. But yeah, you know, I looked at practices like that and just had, and was kind of like, that seems maybe like not so much heavenly spirits as something else,
that's their nickname for their own greed, I guess, right?
I mean, you can read it as a manifestation of these other forces. And it was also important to look at, you know, in each of the sites in the book, I'm also interested in just doing a deep history of that specific place and the forces that have shaped it. And so, you know, looking prior to the discovery of oil in Western Pennsylvania and Western New York, you know, the indigenous history of that region is that, you know, they were also using oil in their own way. It was often used medicinally and it had like it had spiritual importance. And so, and was an item of trade. So it was like, it got around. And so understanding that is also a way of understanding that like resources are utilized in certain ways by certain societies. And that it's not inherent in oil itself, that it even is this destructive thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another resource that was utilized in a destructive way by colonists that you talk about, but is utilized differently by indigenous people in North America, for example, are our waterways. And so at the same time as oil is exploding, right, you have this mass building of hydroelectric power and dams and things like that. What did you find in some of your research about how that affected Native indigenous communities and also some of the ways that the capitalists doing that would justify it using kind of like those same tropes?
Yeah, so what got me interested in dams was actually an example in Maryland where there's this there's an area on the Susquehanna River that has that had like large petroglyphs sort of inscribed on the rocks around the narrow part of the river. And of course, the Narrows is where it was most effective to build a dam. And so in as the dam was being constructed, sort of the local scientific society in Maryland was trying to get the petroglyphs preserved in their view by actually removing them from the river. And so that kind of, and they ultimately like removed them with dynamite and then kind of like tried to piece them back together with cement. And so that like combination of erasing, claiming, and then they start to tell stories again about how the petroglyphs might have been created by a lost non-Indian race. And so it, that move of taking them and sort of re-signifying them, all triggered by this dam being constructed in order to harness the river's power, evoked for me this larger history of dam building, which is, you know, Nick Estes writes about it in his book, Our History is the Future. You know, just that across the West, dams flooded the most important, the most vital indigenous lands. And that this, again, was a practice, a sort of non-military way of taking indigenous land.
And when you say non-military way, it's also it's helpful to see those things in tandem, right? As capitalism being an extension of power in very similar ways in tandem with military power and conquering and you know all of the ways that we the more surface level ways that we perceive we see how westward expansion went.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think a really central message of the book is that it's just that the way that capitalism and its need for continuous growth has become equated with spiritual necessity, and life itself, that, you know, without, and so we see this in the sort of congressional discussion of the need for dam building in the West. You know, senators and congressmen are out there arguing that if we don't do this, if we don't build these dams and make this semi-arid land arable for, you know, industrial scale agriculture, this will represent like the decline of our civilization. And so they very openly like speak in these sort of apocalyptic tones, that if we don't do this, if we don't exploit every possible resource, that will be it for us.
It is unbelievable too, because that time just seems so characterized by this drive forward. I mean, I'm about to go the long way to talk about Manifest Destiny and how that is just a through line, and it shows itself in different ways. And in terms of the dams that were built throughout the U.S. and destroying a lot of native sites and lands, what were, in your research, you know, what were some other egregious examples that you can think of, particularly because when it comes to dam building and during that time period, because then I do want to move into the 20th century, where we can go to the southwestern U.S., but I just I didn't want to move off of this too quickly.
Yeah, well, and so a lot of that dam building is early 20th century, actually, and so you know, it's, we think about sort of the Depression era dam building as it, you know, it's often sort of in the History Channel version. It's inspirational, you know, because this sort of lifted the U.S. out of the Depression, and it fueled U.S. power during World War II. And so I think, like, it's not to, like, discredit the possibility of public works, which I think are very important and are like a very important element of a Green New Deal and any kind of future where we don't all die. So it's not to discredit the possibility of that, but yeah, to like look very carefully at who is asked to bear a disproportionate burden. And I mean, specifically in this case, like Indigenous nations are being denied sovereignty with these moves. And so, I mean, almost all of these major dams, I mean, I can't think of one that didn't, I mean, so like the Columbia Dam is an example of something that was, you know, essentially pushed people off their land.
Right. Well, and so, you know, right, this is World War II expansion, as you say, and then in the 40s and 50s, there was a technological advancement in terms of nuclear weaponry that also touched and affected Native populations in this country. Can you talk about New Mexico and what you found there?
Yeah, so what first got me interested in, or what first kind of clued me into the fact that there was a relationship between the actual resources of uranium and the sort of spiritual significance that tourists and white settlers had ascribed to that sort of Four Corners region in the Southwest was actually a Willa Cather novel, The Song of the Lark, where the protagonist of the novel is walking through like an ancestral Puebloan site and see, you know, there are all of these pot sherds around and she's looking at the pots and she's being inspired by, again, this sort of feeling of inheritance, of continuity with the past. And she's an opera singer. And this experience kind of transforms her singing style into this new American voice. And so that scene in that novel just like sort of emblematized in so many ways, again, that colonization of the past and use of these places as spiritual resources. And so, you know, I knew about the history of the Manhattan Project in New Mexico. And so I kind of started trying to put together those sides of the narrative and found that, of course, the scientists who were relocated to Los Alamos for the Manhattan Project were very much engaged as a hobby in collecting pottery, touring, being tourists, attending Indigenous dances. And things like that. And so I was really interested in that connection that these people who were building the bomb were also drawing kind of their sense of identity and belonging from the history of the place.
And you know, the building of the atomic weapon is the ultimate example, I think, of the United States continuing to try to fortify or build up their strength through force, and for it to culminate in that way, there is a sad poetry to it.
Yeah, and as a source of power, you know, and a lot of this book is in some ways thinking about climate change, thinking right. about how entrenched resources and these particular ways of using resources have become in our society. And so there was an interesting symmetry between nuclear power in the second half of the 20th century and this like absolutely apocalyptic thing, that the cost of U.S. global hegemony was this potential foreclosure of everyone's future in a very like permanent and horrifying way. That was the price that we had to pay in order to secure power. And oil and climate change have taken on sort of a similar kind of valence with increasing awareness of, you know, the greenhouse effect and stuff like that. So when I was looking at the anti-nuclear movement, I was definitely intrigued by the resonances with the present moment.
And a lot of that is definitely present in your book. And a lot of it, too, is, to put it bluntly, I'm consistently amazed by white people's ability to center themselves in this country as an extension, because, you know, there seems to be a theme of white supremacy throughout culture, allowing for very little room for expressions of agency that do not come from whiteness. I'm like thinking about Mississippi Burning, the movie, for example, which is like about the civil rights movement, but it's really about how two FBI agents really were the heroes of that story, for example. I mean, that is a dynamic that we're still fighting to this day, but it's really incredible how you can trace those historical roots in so many and go down so many different paths with it.
Yeah, I think I hadn't necessarily thought about it in that light, but yeah, it definitely is about understanding the way these reading critically the way these stories are being constructed and the politics that exist around what is presented as kind of maybe like literary or entertaining. Again, tourism is a really interesting element of it, that like this is all, and you know, the national parks are a great example of that. Megan K. Nelson has a new book out about the history of Yellowstone, and it's very much what you're describing, this kind of like orientation towards the landscape and history that very much centers whiteness like in this teleological narrative.
Yeah, it is. There's a whole, you know, land. Is it the land back movement? Is that what people are referring it to that as the returning of our national parks to native populations as a way to repair
that,
right?
Starting
there. I mean, in terms of that kind of repair, what's your perception of you know, how that should if we should go about it that way, if that's a good place to start, etc.
Yeah, well, I think a big purpose of like working on this book for me was also to put authors who I think do have good ideas about that stuff, like on the radar of readers who, you know, I mean, it's like I'm trained as an academic and this is a trade book. And so I was kind of hoping to use it as a way of, again, like turning people on to writers who have been really significant to me. You know, people like Nick Estes, Kim Tallbear, Gina Gilio Whittaker, who has a book about indigenous environmentalism. And so I think these are all people who are like, have the ideas that need to be listened to. And I think, yeah, like return of land is a really significant part of that. And yeah, like I kind of look to those writers as like, what they're saying to do is like kind of what I would support.
Deferral. Right. Well, I mean, not deferral in a bad way. I just mean in terms of like your sourcing, those are great people to check out as well, but definitely everybody should check out In Whose Ruins, Power, Possession and the Landscapes of American Empire. Alicia, I'm sorry. I can't thank you enough for coming on today. I really appreciate it. It was a great discussion.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. with that, we'll wait a second before we head into the fun half. Let's just take a quick break. Maybe we'll do an extra clip. One sec. Yeah. We are back, wrapping up the first hour of the Majority Report. If you are watching on YouTube, we are again going to be moving to a second stream for the fun half.
Oh, yeah, and actually we should put that link in the description. It should be there soon. It'll be there by the time we get done playing this next clip here.
So Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, a little while ago, put together a proposal for Biden to cancel $50,000 of student debt. And the Chuck Schumer, to his credit, has been persistently putting pressure on Biden to this degree, not to the extent I wish he would, and we should be canceling all of it. Biden on the campaign trail promised to cancel $10,000 of student debt, which is laughably low, $50,000 obviously better. But Biden seems to be more seriously considering actually doing something about this now. The memo writing team of student debt intellectuals must be really hard at work, because it's been like a year since Biden said he was putting together a task force to consider whether he could legally do this. He obviously can legally do this. But here's Chuck Schumer continuing the pressure, asking Biden to finally take action on student debt.
Now on student debt, for over a year, one of my top priorities as majority leader has been urging President Biden to cancel $50,000 in student debt for each student loan borrower. Right now, as discussions continue within the administration about the future of student debt, I again call on the president to take action, which he can do on his own, and hit the financial reset button for millions and millions of Americans. President Biden's done the right thing by continuing the moratorium on student loan payments. His actions have saved millions from financial ruin during the COVID crisis. But borrowers don't just need their debts paused. They need them erased. These extensions have been crucial, but borrowers can indefinitely plan out their financial futures 3 months at a time with the fear hanging over them that payments will resume down the line. With the flick of a pen, President Biden could provide millions upon millions of student loan borrowers a new lease on life. And he can do it without congressional action, because we know so many of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle are opposed to it.
Good. I mean, it's true. And, you know, I saw a tweet from at Tasha Kaminsky on Twitter yesterday. If Biden cancels all student debt, I will put up a gold frame picture of him in my living room like he's JFK and I'm Catholic or something, which made me laugh. But it's true in terms of young people in this country. Does Biden want to have some sort of legacy with the generation that's going to come after the one that his donor base includes? Because canceling student debt is a way to do that. I know that he's terrified of pissing off some, and this is certainly not all older people, but there is, I mean, we'll play a Jeanine Pirro clip later in the show. There are older voters who say, I didn't get any of my debt canceled, who believe that debt should be used as a disciplinary tool for, you know, the crime of wanting to get an education when you were a kid and being an 18-year-old, potentially signing a piece of material, a contract to get a loan, and then maybe having difficulty paying off that loan later in life. It's also just canceling debt is beneficial for other industries as well. I mean, I know that the real estate market is booming right now, but if you want a certain generation to purchase homes, getting rid of student debt would free them up to do that. So I am appreciative of the fact that Biden has continued to delay this, but I am flummoxed by his tepidness on this issue. He should have canceled it yesterday. If he eventually cancels it and continues to pause the payments, that's fine. But I am curious when he does it, because it's looking like, and fingers crossed, it's looking like he will. If he does it after the election, which is my guess, I think he's going to wait until after the midterms because he's terrified of those voters that I described. The only people that the Biden administration seems to listen to or fears are conservative voters, centrist older voters that they get donations from.
And they're uneasy with exciting the youth electorate too much, frankly. Right.
Exactly. There we go. That's
like they're underwater with it, but like that's what I think I predict, like, they're going to extend the moratorium, which will be better than nothing. And
but don't you want to excite the youth electorate? Like, that's what's so crazy to me. Like
Manchin and Sinema,
no, they don't. Right. Like, right.
Those people don't. A lot of centrist corporate Democrats don't want those people excited. They want them there enough to vote and have them win their elections, but I don't think they want them excited like that.
Well, then you start thinking about what else is possible.
Exactly.
It's the same reasoning that Nancy Pelosi opted for the much costlier and more bureaucratic COBRA extension as opposed to temporarily expanding Medicare. If you temporarily expand Medicare during a pandemic, people are going to realize, wait, why can't we do this all the time?
Yeah. And just dispense with...
Why can't we cancel all of the debt?
All of the, like, J.D. Vance saying this is, policy for privileged people. You look at actually who owns debt. It's not like it's guys like J.D. Vance.
No. They really don't have a ton of angles on this topic. So that's what they're going with. But it seems pretty obvious that... the people who need most student loan relief are not wealthy kids.
Yeah, I mean, J.D. Vance says, like, it implies that it's, and anybody, I should say, not just J.D. Vance, but a lot of the people, like the Morning Joe crowd, and anybody who would just imply that this is for, like, wealthy, children of privilege. It's, I mean, you look at who owns the most, who's disproportionately affected by student loan debt, and it's Black women. And I think, like, and other types of minorities. So, like, those and people like J.D. Vance, they want them to be ground down financially and have to desperate for any
forced sort into a particular workforce
to serve a capitalist for sustenance.
Exactly. That is the goal of conservatives and corporate Democrats in this area: increase insecurity among a population, and they would say increase hunger. Right? Work hard. There's an understanding, though, with our generation and even with, you know, people older than us who get it, that this is just not realistic. It's just not realistic.
Yeah, as opposed to, like, you know, just the way we just, I mean, even in recent history, like the CARES Act gave, like, oh, yeah, we give you COVID stimulus payments of $2,000 and plus 600 or whatever. And every corporation gets like $14,000 of not $14,000, but per each person. So like that's the way that math went out. So like if the government spent like sort of $14,000 per each person for that, you got $2,000 of that and corporations got the rest.
Yep. With that said, folks, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, Matt, what happened on Left Reckoning last night?
Yeah, we had a really good long discussion with Luke Savage about his book, The Dead Center. We talked a little bit about Elon in the postgame. Tonight, though, for our $10 and above Patreons, David and I are doing a hangout at 7.
Are you getting confused about the time zones?
I'm getting the time zone confused, but I believe it is at 6 Eastern time. But tonight you can find it out on patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're going to be doing a Zoom with folks. So,
fun.
Look forward to that. And, yeah, we had Luke on last night, so you can check out that episode if you don't want to, you know, pay us on Patreon. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right. Well, with that said, but you know, definitely check out Scam Economy. Definitely check out Doomed. Definitely check out The Discourse with Brandon. Are we going to, bring them in now? Oh, okay. We have the ability to do that. Nice. Wow. Look at that. I thought I was going to have to do your plugs for you. Hello, friends.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. What's happening over on Doomed/Scam Economy, Binder?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the you know, you saw that beautiful Nancy Pelosi Brazil TikTok account and you automatically thought of me.
I'm sorry for doxing you and letting people know about your alt.
That's okay. That's okay. I do find it amazing, though, that Nancy Pelosi Brazil was taken by me. A very obvious username to use for Nancy Pelosi. But anyway.
It's a Nancy Pelosi fan cam. That's what Binder's been doing on TikTok recently.
Right, right. And you outed me. You found it. You doxed me.
I did.
All right. So on Doomed on Tuesday, I had on Lance from the Serfs, and we talked about Elon Musk buying Twitter and what does that mean and why conservatives are rejoicing and whether they should rejoice and whether Elon Musk will actually even end up buying Twitter. There's so many questions and so little answers. But we had a lot of fun talking about it all on Doomed at youtube.com/Matt Binder and at doomedcast.com for the audio version of the show. And then tonight on Scam Economy is really, and I don't say this for all my episodes, this is a really amazing episode because I had on Mario Gomez, who is a Salvadorian activist who was arrested last year, might be the only person ever to have been arrested for protesting Bitcoin. El Salvador is all in on Bitcoin, and their authoritarian president is doing everything possible to promote it. A lot of possibly shady things going on there, and Mario Gomez runs through it all with me, and it's really a fascinating interview. Definitely check it out. It'll be live on YouTube tonight and also at scameconomy.com.
Amazing. Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
I'm going to resist jinxing myself by plugging anything specific, so I'm going to say just check us out on Patreon, and you'll find out when it happens. Absolutely.
All right. Well, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. We'll be reading your IMs and taking your calls and doing some clips. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Boom.
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? You safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start life.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge Matt.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
wrong.
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.